My grandmother was born in 1914. Oof. So we're talking about ancestors from the 1800s and stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was like, it's only in my head. I swear I will say it to this day because I heard them talking to me. Mm-hmm. And I heard them tell me, we didn't bring you this far. That's what I heard them say.
For you to give up.
Yes, about money. It's only money is what I heard them say. And that shifted for me. So people see, you know, like they think you've been a success or I've been doing, you know, really well for a long time. And they don't understand that it takes so much time and effort. A lot of work has gone into getting to the place where I'm at right now.
Welcome to Michelle is Money Hungry. I'm your host, Michelle Jackson. And today I am thrilled to have the following guest on the show. She is a friend of mine, but she is one of those people that I expect great things from now and in 2020. She is one of those people that you need to be watching, need to be following, and need to be learning from because she is so passionate about her mission to empower people of color with money. She is the creator of the Hustle Crew, which has at this point, at the moment we're recording, about 13 or 14,000 people. She is the creator of the Elevate Workshops, which is a community that she's created or an event that she's created for POC and the personal finance space to help us connect, collaborate, and share the things that work and don't work, talking about money for people of color. She's also the creator of the Elevate Community. So if you're a person of color who is looking to talk about money or has created a community where you're sharing personal finance and personal finance related content, definitely make sure that you are going into that space. Not everyone can get in though.
That's true.
Be clear and make sure you answer the questions. So she has some questions in there that she's asking you, there's a reason for that. That would be for any group, by the way, and that's on Facebook. So today, the guest is Sandy Smith. I am so excited to have you joining me. If you could just introduce yourself beyond what I said, that would be awesome.
I feel like that was a great introduction. Okay, So who am I? I am the creator of Fight Called YesIAmCheap.com. where I help people live their best financial lives. As you've mentioned, I created the Elevate Community, which is committed to amplifying the voices of people who speak to people of color about education, because I'm committed to reaching underserved communities, particularly people of color and women. And if you're intersectional like I am, if you're a Black female, even better, reaching them about financial education. And what else do I do? I don't know. I feel like I do a host of things. The Hustle Crew, of course, which is helping people find and create their ways to make extra money outside of their jobs. Sorry, I feel like something just went off in my background.
It did. Don't worry about it. What I'd like to know is how you ended up in the personal finance space. Like, what happened to get you talking about money? And when did that even start?
So that started 10 years ago. So January 1st, 2019, my computer's going crazy. I apologize ahead of time. 2009 is when my blog went live officially.
I was like, what is happening?
We went backwards, right? My blog went live January 1st, 2009. I had had some time off at the end of the year. The company that I was working for at the time gave you the time off between Christmas and New Year's automatically. So I took some time to build my blog. Oh my gosh, my computer's just going with all these crazy notices. I apologize.
I can't hear anything, so.
Okay, great. I took some time to build my blog in December of 2008, and then went live January 1st, 2009. And the reason why that happened is because I finally started looking at my finances. I had a job that I think I was, you know, doing pretty good at. I had some student loans I was paying, but I felt like I wasn't really getting anywhere. So I was like, let me just start writing down how much I owe. And mentally I understood that I owed my student loans. I owed some credit card bills because I, you know, put stuff on my card from when I went to school. I had a business that closed. So I had some liabilities left over from there and I was paying that. But it wasn't until I put them all together in one place that I realized how much I actually owed in total. And when I did, I freaked out. It was like $122,000, something like that. And for many people, that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but for me, it did, because I wasn't making so much money per year. $122,000 was an exorbitant amount of money because I didn't own anything. I didn't own a car. I didn't own a house. I didn't own anything. So I decided that I was going to become more accountable to what I was doing with my money and just track my spending. And that's how my site was started and how I kind of went down the rabbit hole of personal finance. And here we are a decade later, and man, it's really kind of balled into something else.
I want to talk about something that you don't talk about that often anymore that I think is very relatable to a lot of people, which is something that happened with your business and just supporting family. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that a lot of people don't know about you anymore, that you had a period of intense financial distress. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about being the one person supporting four people and what that looked like? Because that is the genesis of your hustle crew.
It really is.
And I think that people really have no idea about, like, I know because I talk to you like daily.
Yes.
But for years. But I think that it's really important to talk about the genesis of why you were hustling the way that you were, besides being an immigrant, which is a piece of that too. So could you touch on that briefly?
Yeah. So during the height of the recession, my business closed. I had a boutique. I employed about four people and I had to lay them off, close my business. So there was that. I did have a regular job as well. So I had my job, but I woke up one day and I realized that I was the one person who was working between two houses. So at the time, my mother lived across the street, four houses down. My stepdad had been laid off. His company had closed. My mom was on disability. My brother wasn't working at the time. He ended up creating his own business. And there was my little sister who was in high school. And then in my house across the street, there was myself, my now husband, his mom, who we took care of, and my husband's nephew.
That's more than four people, by
the way. Well, I mean, my parents were kind of getting by on disability and unemployment and like some pension payments.
But you were throwing in money for sure. I know you were, because I know.
You know, as much as I could help, you know, but yeah. I realized that between two houses, there were eight of us and I was the one person working. Mm-hmm. And that was super stressful. That was very, very stressful. I really needed to hold on to my job, and I was working someplace that I didn't necessarily like in a role that I didn't necessarily love, but it was a job. So I held on to it. But then I was thinking, okay, I've got to make some extra money. How do I supplement my income? Mm-hmm. And I was working full time and had a long commute. My commute was probably an hour and a half each way. Jesus. And it was very difficult for me to, you know, make extra money, you know, having a second job. I actually did apply for a second job to work at Macy's on the weekend. I'd never really worked retail, and I ended up not starting there because I was like, I'm too tired. What I ended up doing was I ended up just starting to sell, and I had been selling on like eBay and stuff for years, but I wasn't really focused on it. But I started selling stuff online, and then it really kicked into gear when I lost my job later on. And I started selling on Amazon a lot, and making money that way. But I always tried to have another thing to make some extra money one way or another. And that was part of the reason why I ended up starting the Hustle Crew, because I knew that there were so many people out there that were like me that needed to supplement income and maybe didn't know all the different ways that they can make extra money. So yeah, there was that crazy period where I was the one person working between two households and eight people. It was kind of nuts to think about it now.
One of the things I want to touch on, and one of the reasons why I wanted to speak with you, is you have created this community for people of color who share financial information and who are cultivating communities to educate other people who may or may not hear messages about money from people that look like them.
Right.
And so I felt like it was important to, one, touch on why is it important for us to have something separate from our 9-to-5 And then two, why it was important for you to create communities such as the Elevate community.
So when I lost my job, I pivoted into human resources. And I got, I think, a bigger idea into, or an insight into the background of how companies really think when it comes to their workers. And one of the biggest things I think that impacted and really, really pushed me to really force people to earn money outside of their jobs is that I realized that human resources role is not for the employees per se. They walk a tightrope between protecting the company, that is their main job, by the way, and dealing with human capital. And there were enough times where I had to terminate somebody or, you know, just get rid of people because the company needed to save money. Is that fair to the person who's coming in every day working, doing a good job? It's not. I'd been on the other side a couple of times. When you work in New York and you're in finance and they're not making money, they lay people off. Oh, you're laying off 2,000 people. It just sounds like a number. It doesn't even sound like real people until right. You're in the building and you're seeing the phone calls go down the line and you know you're next and you start packing up your box because you know, okay, they're getting rid of all these people. So being on the other side and having to be the one to tell somebody they no longer had a job, I realized that I didn't like doing that. Nobody likes doing that. But I realized just how unprepared people were if they no longer worked at their company, if they had done nothing wrong, right? And if they just suddenly no longer had employment. So I really wanted people to be prepared enough to have something, you know, I would say break glass, make money. Just in case, because unemployment in New York City is not going to cut it. You get a maximum of $420 a week. That's before taxes. That's not going to pay anyone's rent or anything in New York City. So I wanted people to be able to supplement their income just as I was supplementing my income before when my whole family was like underemployed. And
actually, I'm going to interrupt you and ask a question or ask you this question. When someone says to you, but my employer says we're like family, what's your reaction?
Your family just up until the company needs to save money. We're going to be honest. There are companies that will love you and hold on to you and try their best to keep you. But when push comes to shove and they're not making money and they have to make those hard decisions, it may not be easy. They may not want to. But if it means that getting rid of one person who's been here for 10, 15 years, and that person is making $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, guess what? That's what they're going to have to do. And by the way, that's a real example. Somebody working for a company that was making $100,000 plus that I had to terminate because the company wanted to save money. And, you know, and his manager didn't want to get rid of him. He didn't. But they needed to save money in that department. And that's what he ended up having to do. Not nice. Now, the reason why I specifically focus on amplifying the voices of individuals who speak to people of color is I read a story, a study by Prudential, when they were talking about the financial outlook of people of color in the United States. And we were talking a lot about the disparities and the numbers and things. And one of the things I liked about the study was that they had solutions as to how there could be improvements for they had done different studies for women, for LGBTQ, for people of color, et cetera. But I read the one on people of color. And one of the solutions that they had was that there needed to be greater representation in personal finance when it came to people of color, because people gravitated to people who look more like them because they thought that they could understand their stories. Like they wouldn't be judged. Like if I came to somebody and I said, you know, I'm an immigrant and I'm the one person working and there's like four other members of my family or three other members of my family. And the person sitting across from you is also an immigrant. You feel like they'll understand your story a little bit better than somebody who doesn't have the same background or who doesn't, you know, have that going on. So that's one of the solutions that they had. And I thought that's actually brilliant. And so I said, how can I help this? And there were enough people out there that I knew in the personal finance field who were people of color, but I realized that other people didn't see them or didn't know who they were. So I really wanted to start amplifying their voices and making people more visible so that we could reach the people who really needed this information, but didn't think that there were people out there who looked like them.
One of the things that I like about you creating the Elevate community and Elevate workshops is you took an action. And I think that a lot of people really way overthink taking action, like that there are solutions that they could be facilitating to problems, but they think really hard about all the reasons why they shouldn't. Did you go through that process, or were you like, I see an easy way to do this thing? And then what was it like to host your first in-person event to facilitate connections, camaraderie, and education with these other financial educators, if you will?
So putting into action was really easy for me, I guess, because I was really following a lot of the philosophy that Barack Obama had kind of put out. And one of the things that he kept saying was, be the change you want to see. Mm. So I realized it wasn't up to somebody else. It was up to me. You know, why am I going to wait for somebody else to do it and to do the things that I thought needed to get done when I felt it was incumbent on me to be that person first? So, you know, I reached out to my friends and thankfully, you know, educated them a little bit and say, hey, I want to really highlight how badly people of color are doing financially, and not just highlighting the numbers. I want us to be the solution here. I want them to see themselves in each of us, or, you know, one of us can appeal to a particular person, another person appeals to a different kind of person. If they continue to see other people who speak about personal finance, who look like them, they'll find somebody who they can connect with. And we can start to be the solution to the problems that we're seeing instead of just talking about the problems. So that part was pretty easy for me. Now, in creating the conference, that took a little bit more, because I was not confident that people would show up. I didn't know that people would see value in those of us who talk personal finance, specifically to people of color, that they would see value in coming together for an event for us, by us.
But I don't understand that, because we attend events like FinCon and Lola and Sense Positive, like people, you know what I mean? So we're attending events. Why would it be that we wouldn't attend one for us?
Well, I thought that there were so many events out there that just were larger, had bigger connections, and delivered so much value. I just didn't know that people would say that there needed to be one more, or one that was specifically for the people who addressed the problems that we were talking about.
So and it took a
lot of convincing, I think, from my peers to just go ahead and do it. You know, that people who said to me, it's necessary, just do it. If people show up, they show up. If they don't, they don't. But we're going to support you in these efforts. And I was surprised, but very happy that the support came from not just within the communities of color, but outside as well, with people that others would probably refer to as allies, who wanted to make sure that people knew that people of color, underprivileged, underserved people, knew that there was this event out there that, you know, they could attend that was focused on addressing the particular concerns and problems that were in that community. And not only were they sharing the event, but people put their money forward as well to support the effort. And that part of it made a world of difference for me, that, you know, friends came forward and said, we want to support what you're doing. We see that there is this gap here, and we want other people to have this experience with you. So that was actually pretty good. Once I decided firmly that I really wanted to do it, because I was kind of on the fence, once I decided to do it, it rolled really, really quickly, I think.
Were you surprised at the response for the initial event? I know that you're planning the second one and that it's going very well. So let's just briefly talk about what's going on now with Elevate Workshop and who it's specifically for. So it's not for everybody.
No, it's not for everyone.
So kind of talk about that too.
So I was really shocked at the outcome. At the end of the first Elevate Influencer event, they asked, when's the next one going to be? And in my head, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to have another one. but basically, the audience basically forced me to. They're like, we should do the next one in DC around this time. And they literally stood there with me at the closing event, where we were kind of mingling with each other and having some champagne and stuff. And they were like, let's go through the calendar, this date. And there were literally like five or six people who stood with me and was like, okay, it's going to be in DC. It's going to be on this date. And I'm like, you guys figured that out basically for me ahead of time. They're like, yeah, because there needs to be another one of these. This was great. This was not like anything that we've attended, and this is needed. So basically they chose the date and time for me on the last day at the closing event of the first event. And everybody sold more tickets now than the total amount of seats that we had for the first event.
Wow.
So yeah, we're basically going 2.5 times the size of the last event. I'm really surprised by it. I don't know. I didn't expect the reception that we've gotten. And I definitely have people reaching out to speak at the event, to, you know, have vendors and things like that at the event. Definitely have had some large companies interested in sponsoring the event already. So it's going really well. I hope that it can grow into something that's really beneficial for the people that it's targeting. Now, who is it targeting? It is specifically for people whose audience is primarily comprised of people of color, and they speak personal finance to that audience. And that's why this particular event is called Elevate Influencer, because it's reaching the influencers, and it's geared towards two things. The first part of the day, the first day is a two-day event. The first day is community focused. So it's addressing the issues and problems that we're seeing within the community and really discussing them in a way that we don't necessarily get to discuss them openly and honestly, and trying to figure out solutions, because I'm very solution oriented. I like a discussion, but a discussion just for discussion's sake doesn't mean anything. Mm. I want us to have actionable things that we can take away. The second day is focused on our businesses, because while women of color particularly are the fastest growing group of entrepreneurs, our businesses don't grow as big as they should and they fail faster. So I want to arm these particular individuals with the information that they need to both grow and build their businesses and make them lasting and sustainable. And for us to be able to go from one man show or two person show, which is usually a couple, to building their businesses. Because I know that if they're building their businesses, they're reaching more individuals. So that's why Elevate Influencer is specific to the audience that it wants to reach. Now, beyond that, the workshops plan to reach the community that we serve. So there will be additional workshops, particularly targeting our audiences and not the influencers. And those are coming soon. And for those, we're partnering with the Plutus Foundation, and they're committed to driving financial education to underserved communities as well. So I'm excited about what's to come in the future and how it's kind of growing bigger than I could have hoped that it would have been at this point in time. I think I'm at year 3 or 4 that I thought would be in my head. And this isn't even our first full year of like official events. Our first event was in May. We're, you know, 7 months out basically. So, you know, growing faster than I thought. So the need is there and people supporting what's needed.
What would you say are the top 3 issues that POC are dealing with financially, or even dealing with in terms of engaging with people in the financial space?
So I think one of the biggest things that we all deal with is income disparity. Mm-hmm. The statistics will tell you that income is rising for people of color. It is. However, the disparities still exist and they're still vast. So getting to a point where things are more equal than they are right now is very important to quite a lot of us. So even though we're in personal finance, there are a lot of us who are talking to people about their careers, how to negotiate their salaries, how to level up, you know, when it comes to that, because ultimately at some point, it's not how people necessarily manage their money. It's how much money they have to manage. Mm. So we need to make sure people are maximizing their ability to earn at their jobs, because that's where people earn their most money. So that's one of the top reasons, one of the top issues I think we're facing. The second is the crazy housing problems that we're seeing. Home ownership amongst people of color are at the same rate that they were in the 1950s. Zero progress. It's, you know, we're in a whole different decades and decades later. And we know that home ownership is a pathway to building lasting wealth. If we can increase the rate of home ownership amongst people of color, we will always be behind. However, we know that there are issues behind that. There's redlining. The homes that are in traditional communities of color are severely undervalued. So this access to capital, even with the same credit scores, people of color are often offered loans that cost them more money than they should. So, you know, kind of educating people around home ownership in general and preparing people for home ownership and helping them through the process of applying for and gaining loans that I think are meaningful to them is another thing that I think many of us are working on. And even just educating people about programs that are out there that they can apply for that would assist them as they go through home ownership and just increasing their knowledge is a really big part of what we're doing. And the third part, I think, is that many of us are very not knowledgeable about investing, but we want to invest. We just don't know enough. So there's a good portion of us now that, okay, maybe you're not in debt and you've learned that, or you have a manageable amount of debt, but you've got a little bit of extra money, or you know that you should be investing and you want to invest. There's a good portion of us that are focused on investing as a way to increase wealth because we know that's another pillar of wealth building. You've got to have your money working for you. So there are a good number of us who are back to basics, teaching people about their 401ks even, because that's where most of us are investing our money, even though we don't think about that as investing. The 401ks, trading and investing, just teaching about that. Those three things, I think, are some of the big things that can really turn around what we see as numbers for that are negative for people of color and can really start to drive wealth. And that's where I'm kind of focused as well, making sure that we're making enough in our jobs, that if we're buying homes, we're doing so at the best rate for us and we understand the home ownership process and that we make our money work for us and feel comfortable being part of the stock market and investing in that way so that we can drive generational wealth. That's where I'm focused. And those are the three that I think are the big issues I think are facing people of color.
While you were talking, I thought about two other things that I want you to touch on, which is money mindset and time. So I think that in my observation, regardless of who the person is, black, white, green, whatever, money mindset plays a huge role in what they do. Yeah. With their money, like how empowered they feel, how bold they feel about what they're doing, how comfortable they feel negotiating for more, whether or not they believe they deserve more, whether or not they stay in a situation that's bad for them physically and emotionally. And then there's the time piece, which is sometimes it just takes time to get the results. And I feel like nowadays people are very unwilling to understand that it takes time to get results.
It does.
So if you could talk about those two pieces, I think that it'll be interesting to hear your insight into that, because the longer I talk about money and quite honestly observe my own self, I had the hardest area of work that I had to focus on for me was mindset. Yep. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
It's actually step one. And I think a lot of us don't realize that, because you need to either know that you have a problem with your spending or your earning or your debt, or you want to buy a house or you want to do X, Y, Z. That's the first step. And you don't realize that changing the way that you think about money or being more mindful about money is the very first step, because there's something that clicks in your head that makes you focus on these things. And having this, you know, this mindset that either is going to have you be a go-getter or want you to learn more about something, change your situation, do better, whatever that thing is, something has to click in your brain that turns you on to that and makes you more open to that, or makes you feel like you want to work a little bit harder, learn a little bit more. And that's the first step. And people don't realize that this happens, because it's an internal change that we don't often recognize as step one, but it is step one. And some people are just more mindful about it. They recognize this, you know, they understand there's this change that I want to make. And they seek out probably a little bit more information about that. And that's where people talk about their emotional intelligence or emotional quotient. Mm. That's the new terminology everybody's using.
EQ.
But,
yes.
but it's that shift that occurs at the very beginning that we often don't even realize has occurred. And it's the smallest thing. The shift for me was recognizing that I owe all this money and I'm not getting anywhere just paying the minimums. I need to do something else. Boom, shift, you know? And when that shift happened, I started to get more results because I was more focused on it. I was more cognizant. I paid a little bit more attention. I sought more information. I wanted more education. I immersed myself into the entire finance thing. Not to say that everybody should or would, but the minute you decide that you want to make a change or you have a goal, that's that money mindset that people talk about that makes it seem like it's this big thing, but it really isn't, because it's the first thing that happens at the very, very, very beginning. And it's this tiny little spark that, you know, lights the flame that makes you want to make that change. So that's the first thing. Yeah, time. I think I've been talking more about this lately because I'm 10 years in and there are people who are finding me now, 10 years in. And they have no clue about the work that it's taken to get where I'm at right now.
But Sandy, you're an overnight success.
Oh, yeah. It's a 10-year overnight success. I remember one of the first comments that I got when people were like, you have no idea because you're X, Y, or Z, or you don't understand. And I'm like, oh.
And that's why I asked you to share your story, your origin story, because I don't think people who are new to you now understand where you've come from.
They have no idea. Yes. You know, depressed about money, having that stress about being the one person who had a job, trying to hold on to it.
People call you looking for their cash.
Yes. having the New York State Department of Taxation show up at my mom's house looking for me because I owe taxes from closing my business, you know, hiding out from people that I owe money to, like stressed out to the point where my hair is falling out. Like this, people don't know.
My hair fell out so badly. You know that I still, to this day, like it probably won't grow back. That's why I wear wigs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
stress. That stress is crazy. Standing, when my grandmother passed away, I was so broke that I could not afford to go to her funeral. Like that level of stress. And to me, my grandmother was like, my grandmother was my second mom because my mom was a young mom. She had been when she was 20. So she was working a lot. Was working. So we were with my grandmother a lot, and to not be able to afford to go to her funeral, like, was really, like, really broke me. You know, my mom
me tear up a little bit.
Yes. My mom paid for me to go to my grandmother's funeral, and I was standing there. I tell the story sometimes as part of a speech that I give, and I was standing there. I went to an area where my mom was born. My mom was born in a one room house.
Yep.
And you had to pass through the family grave plot to get to where my mom was born. And I was walking through the plot, and by the way, I was walking with my uncle through this gravesite. My uncle passed away this morning, actually, as we're recording this. And I'm thinking about the story. It was my uncle who took me through this area. And I stopped and I looked at the graves that were to my left and to my right. And they were my ancestors. And I was so in so much despair about not even having the money to be able to come to my grandmother's funeral. My mom had to pay for it. And I was in so much despair. And I looked to my left and my right, and I realized I was standing in my ancestors, amongst my ancestors. And I thought about all the work that they had done to get me to where I was. And I was so upset about not having this money. Mm. And that was like another mindset shift for me. Something clicked in me that day that made me want to, like, go 100% harder. Because I realized these people had done so much to get me where I was now. And yes, I owed it had ballooned to like $130,000 when I added the taxes I owed New York State, by the way. and I was in so much despair about that money, and something clicked in my head that it was only money. Because these people had gone through so much to get me here. I was looking at the dates on those headstones. My grandmother was born in 1914. Ooh. So we're talking about ancestors from the 1800s and stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was like, it's only in my head. I swear I will say it to this day, because I heard them talking to me. Mm-hmm. And I heard them tell me, we didn't bring you this far. That's what I heard them say.
For you to give up.
Yes, about money. It's only money is what I heard them say. And that shifted for me. So people see, like, they think you've been a success or I've been doing, you know, really well for a long time. And they don't understand that it takes so much time and effort. A lot of work has gone into getting to the place where I'm at right now. And that's why I'm so determined to make sure that I pull as many people that I could pull up with me. And people don't understand that. Some people are willing to put in the work, but some people want it overnight. And that doesn't work. The people who tell you you can have it overnight are lying to you. Look out for what they're going to want on the back end, because it's going to cost you one way or another. The people who are real to you and tell you that it takes time. You put in the work now, but you reap the benefits after a while, are being honest with you.
I want to ask you actually about something that, as we were talking, I just start thinking about this, which is not only are people like not completely understanding the amount of time it takes to plant the seeds, nurture them, and make them grow, but that sometimes you have to do things that you don't enjoy. It doesn't mean that you do them forever. It just means that sometimes for a period of time, you do things to get you over that hump. Yep. And I was thinking about this because right now I am in the process of kind of tweaking and changing my business. So at the time that we're recording this episode, it's the end of 2019. And I've decided to actually give up on side hustles and to add freelance writing back into my business. Now, it's funny because I love writing. I write books. Like I still blog. Like I really enjoy writing, but I've never really loved freelance writing as a part of my business because editors get on my nerves. If they're not a good editor for me, it's just a bad fit. So I like the ease of the money though. I guess where I'm going with this is I am now changing how I'm adding clients to make sure that we're a really good fit so I can add in this income stream for a short period of time that will allow me to do other things in my business. It'll free up time basically. And I guess I feel like sometimes people are very unwilling to do things that they don't enjoy. Yes. If it helps them to
suck it up.
It's like you just, so Hazel, Sandy's dog Hazel swallowed Peppa Pig, who I didn't know existed because I don't have kids. And Peppa Pig is a pig in children's worlds. Like, I don't even understand what's happening, but her dog swallowed this pig. Yep. So Sandy ended up making $7,200 building websites. And Sandy, talk about how you feel about building websites.
I absolutely hate doing it, period.
By the way, she did that in a month. So, but why did you decide to tap into the skill set? And what did you kind of learn from that?
Well, I tapped into it because it's something that I knew that I needed to do. I had a list of people who wanted the service. They didn't know that I did this, but I did something for a friend, posted it, and it was like, oh, you do websites? Can you do mine? And I was like, oh, I really hate doing websites, but you're going to pay me to do this? Okay. But I absolutely hate, if there could be a stronger word than hate, I absolutely hate it.
But you did it.
But I did it. I did it. I built 8 or 9 websites in 31 days. That's like one website every 3-point-something days. I was not sleeping. I probably slept a good 3.5 hours a night, maybe 4 max. But I did what I had to do, you know, legally. to get my goal. And there are a lot of times that people don't, we want to be comfortable. Everybody wants to be comfortable, but there's sometimes you've got to do what you don't want to do. I remember I was working at this job that I absolutely hated. I hated the job. Mm-hmm. Paid me a paycheck. And so I sucked it up and I went to work every single day because there was a paycheck there and it was coming in and it was a recession and, you know, I needed a job. So sometimes you got to do what you don't want to do to accomplish the things you want to accomplish, at least in the short term. And I think I talk to people about being uncomfortable because we want to be comfortable all the time. That's human nature. But you have to be willing to be uncomfortable a little bit so that you can get to the point where you are comfortable. Get comfortable with being uncomfortable.
I want to talk about something that came up recently that I thought was hilarious. You got caught in the, I hate to use this phrase, but I feel like it's a good one, crosshairs of the financial independence retire early movement. Ugh,
yes.
And I'm slow fire because I believe that you can change your lifestyle first before you ever hit fire. So how I approach fire is completely different. I'm already living the lifestyle and then I'm building up the income on the back end. I love it. But I felt like everything you were saying completely made sense. Like none of what you were saying was crazy.
And it wasn't wrong.
I was surprised that there was this brouhaha. And then I was like, no, I shouldn't be surprised. So could you talk about fire as it relates to that conversation I'm talking about?
Yes.
It was on Twitter. And then just what surprised you about feedback from other POC actually? And then also just what your thoughts are on the movement and how relatable or unrelatable or possible it is for those of us who aren't white.
So here's what happened. Let me give you a little backstory. There have been a couple of debates online amongst the personal finance people and in the FIRE community, just in general about FIRE and some of these articles that are coming out about people retiring early and extreme and stuff. And I'm watching these conversations ping back and forth on Twitter, and I'm looking at who's in all of these conversations. So I said what was on my mind, and I'm frank and honest. So I basically said, I'm watching all these conversations go, but nobody's noticing that the first step to being able to fire is to be white. I think no one has taken the time to look around the room to realize that the first step to getting the privilege of being able to fire is to be white. Holy moly.
why do you feel that way? Like what is supporting this claim?
I'm not crazy. I know that I'm not crazy. I work in HR, and beyond that, I work in personal finance. I see on the front end, I see it on the back end. Mm-hmm. The statistics support what I'm saying, because here's the thing. And they're real actual statistics. They're Harvard statistics. They're peer-reviewed statistics that will support what I'm saying here. People of color do not have the same opportunities. Shocker. Mm. The one study that sticks out in my head is because it's so related to HR, and I argue this with my peers in human resources as well. I remember the study where they took the very same resume, same formatting, no changes, same thing. All they did was swap the name at the top of the resumes, change the names out. And the names that were ambiguous or Caucasian sounding were getting callbacks all the time. The minute you put an ethnic name, Jose, Mohammed, some, you know, any name that sounded black,
Quinette,
they were not getting callbacks. Mm-hmm. And the disparate was so wide that the people doing the study were shocked. But that was only one example. And so people were like, oh, all you got to do is work hard and pull yourself up by the bootstrap. But guess what? If you can't even get your foot in the job, even if you have the same qualifications, if you can't get your foot in the door to get that job, how are you going to fire if you're not making the same money? If you're telling me Latinas make 54 cents on the dollar to a white man, it takes her all the way to November 20th or November 22nd. Mm. To make the same money that a white man made the year before. You can't tell me we have the same opportunities. It's BS. If you tell me that a black male without a criminal history and has a bachelor's degree has less of a chance of getting the same job as a white male with a high school diploma and a criminal background, you can't tell me that's equal.
But so I'm sure that people were like, well, it's just math, like that.
Yeah,
they
the math
ignored,
doesn't
they,
support it.
But they ignored that part of what your argument is, of what you're stating, and they're like, well, if they have a job, it's just math. Right. So let's assume
that they're underemployed. They're underemployed. It's not the same. They're underemployed. Black male with a bachelorette degree, no criminal activity, has less of a chance of getting the same job as a white male with a criminal background and a high school diploma. They've got to have a bachelor degree to have less of a chance of getting the same job. It is not equal. And when they do get a job, they're underemployed. They're not making the same amount of money.
So then I'm sure they'll be like, well, what about the negotiation process?
And it's not even about that, because the perception is that they don't need to make as much. So that even the offers and the ceilings for where they get the money is much lower than if you're a white male. And they're inherent. People are not, I'm not saying that everybody's racist. What I'm saying is that there is privilege that you're not aware of, that you benefit from, that other people don't have. And there are inherent biases that we all have. We all have them, that affects the ability of people of color to fire.
So then the next thing, so for those of you listening, I was kind of watching this whole thing unfold with some amusement, because I was just like, okay, all right, let's do this. But what was very interesting was that there were some people that we knew who are people of color who were like, but hey, there are people of color who fired.
Exactly.
So what do you say about that?
I say that
there are people of color who have hit fire, and what you've observed about those specific cases.
So I say that those people fired in spite of those challenges. You always have exceptions. You'll have the one or two people, the few people who are able to overcome. So those people fired in spite of those challenges. How much harder did they have to work though? And then when I look around, I'm like, the people who were able to fire, who were people of color, were almost all always had, were self-employed. Or, you know, maybe they had a job, but they had another, they had a self-employment component. It's so difficult to reach fire as a person of color just through your regular employment. Always self-employed, all of them.
It's very interesting, actually. It's either they have a job and self-employment, or there's a couple that I've seen recently in the last few weeks. They're in Portugal right now, but I can't remember.
Oh, yeah. The two of them were working, but they also had their own hustles and their own side business as well.
Yeah, they were doing, like, they were hustling. And so exactly. That goes back to the whole, how uncomfortable they were willing to get.
They were willing to get uncomfortable, but they had their own business. That's what that was.
But they also had their own business, but they were also doing like Uber.
Right. But that's a person who's a 1099er. That's a self-employment, you know, option, you know? So that's what I was trying to point out to people. Like, yes, there are people of color who fire. I'm not saying that people of color can't fire. They're just not as easy, because they have to work so much harder for the same opportunities as, you know, people non-POC. Now you're going to get the people who say, hey, I, you know, grew up in a one room shack and I was able to fire. And it wasn't because I was white. It was just because I worked hard at it. And I say, great. Thank you for proving my point. Even a person who, you know, grew up in a one room shack had a better chance as a white male to fire than somebody who maybe had who didn't grow up in a one room shack somewhere, who was a person of color, and they're having a harder time of it. Thank you for proving my point. And it's not that I'm not going to negate your hard work. Yes, you worked hard. Yes, you went to school. Yes, you did A, B, C, D, but you're also a recipient of a system that inherently has biases that you might not even be aware of, but you are able to benefit from them. David White, you have a better opportunity of going through the world easier than somebody whose name is, you know, Mohammed Hamdi. It's not the same.
It's interesting, because I think fire in general is such a, it's the unicorn financial life. So even for people, you know, I live in Colorado. I know a lot of white people. And it was funny because it's funny to me with fire, because I observe a lot about how people perceive it and that kind of thing. So I notice a lot of white reactions to it. Like people who, it's like this aspirational thing that is so beyond so many people for so many reasons, that I also think that, for lack of a better term, colors their perception of what can be. Likewise, for the people that we know and deal with on a daily basis, I almost feel like a lot of those people forget that they're, for lack of a better term, a unicorn to other people. So we, you know, we've been, again, it's not overnight success. We've been at this for 10 years. You know, I've been in it since 2012. So it's almost 2020. It's almost 8 years. And so I've been paying off thousands and thousands of dollars of debt. And next year will be, I think, a phenomenal year, right? Mm-hmm. That's 9 years in. Like, that's 9 freaking years.
It's a long time.
Work and like struggle and tears. And so I think the other piece is we know a lot of people who've put in an incredible amount of work. And so sometimes what I've noticed is once you get out on the other side, it's not that you forget what it was like. It's just that you want to move. Well, but I think there are some people who forget, and then there's other people who just want to emotionally move on. And I'm going to be frank, like for me, once I'm done with this, like taking care of everything and all this stuff, emotionally, I'm going to want to move on. I won't forget because it's been such a big part of my life, taking care of all this, but emotionally, it's like one of those, it's like a huge transitional phase. And I think it happens very subconsciously where people don't realize like how they talk about things changes. I notice it with people that I know because I'm still kind of deep in the trenches, right?
Right.
And it's not a fault or it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing that you've moved on. But I do think as financial influencers, that that's something we always have to kind of constantly keep, like constantly be mindful of, that we remember our origin story. So we stay relatable to the people that we're trying to help.
Yeah, I guess, you know, trying to focus on making sure that I pull everyone up with me. I often need to remind myself that everyone isn't where I am, that it's taken 10 years, even myself, and trying to make sure that I understand everybody's position, where they're coming from and, you know, where they are at that particular point in time. And even maybe if I'm not the person that they relate to right now, that I find somebody that I think is relatable to their particular situation, that they can, you know, look up to connect them to as an inspiration for them. And at the same time, I'm very cognizant of the fact that now I am visible to other people. And I do want to remember that there are plenty of people that are where I was, you know, and that they still want someone that they can look up to be aspirational towards, to say, hey, Sandy did it. I can do it too. So, you know, it's walking that tightrope is very important to me. And at the same time, again, making sure that I'm pulling those people up with me, because everybody wants that motivation to be able to pull somebody up. But I also want to be able to understand where people are at the same time. So when we were having this conversation on Fire online, and people, and there were people called that were like, but, and I'm just like, I wish you could understand where people are right now. Mm-hmm. And think about all the things that you individually had to overcome to get to X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D, you know, or maybe you particularly didn't have those challenges, but people as a whole have these challenges. You know, everyone tries to relate it only to them specifically. So I'm trying to get people to see the bigger picture, not you, John Q. Public, but the whole entire, you know, group and diaspora. This is a fact for sure, that this entire group is suffering from this as a whole, but maybe not you in particular, you know?
I want to see a panel on Fire, actually.
Fire people of color?
Yes, I would love that. I'm just throwing it out there. but I'm going to ask you a question about what does a typical day look like as you build your online business and brand? What's going on?
Oh my gosh. I think people would think that I'm crazy.
I'm like, I love that you hustle so much, but I'm like, you don't, when people think that things are easy, there's a reason why I'm asking this question, to be honest. Yeah. I want you guys to really understand the kind of work that Sandy is putting in the background. This is on top of being a mom of a little rambunctious toddler, as yes. all toddlers are. She's a spouse. She's a wife. She's a daughter. She's a big sister. So she's got these many different roles. She works full time.
Yep.
She has a commute. So now that I've shared all those things, talk about what you do.
Typical day.
For your business specifically.
I drop my toddler off at daycare at 7:30. I hop on the train by 7:47 and I have a 2-hour one-way commute. So I'm working on my business I split that time between my business and the office stuff, on my commute going in. I'm usually working for work during the daytime, but catching up on business stuff in between as I can, stealing time as I can. Leave the office at about 4:30. My 2-hour one-way commute going back the other direction, again, is split between office and business stuff. Pick up my toddler at before 6:30. Try to get there before 6:30 anyway, before they charge me for extra time. Get home. I try to spend some time in dinner, but I'm working while dinner is cooking or he's playing or whatever. I'm stealing time again in between that. But I'm definitely working again by 8:30. I'm on a computer. And then he goes to sleep at about 10:30 at night. And then I'm working from 10:30 to about 2:30 to 3 o'clock in the morning, on my own business again.
What does that work look like? What is working?
Working is answering emails, writing whatever I need to write, it may be negotiating for things back and forth, amplifying other people's things. So if somebody has a post on social media that I think other people should see, it's amplifying other people's work. So, you know, retweeting, resharing, scheduling those tweets and shares, posting things in my Hustle Crew or scheduling posts that will go into the Hustle Crew, responding to comments and questions, directing people to other resources for where I spend a lot of time, like sharing resources, I think. for where people should go. I think I spend very little time promoting my own stuff, and it's a lot of responding to inquiries and questions from other people about questions that they have about things. It's a lot of that. I end up with a lot of people popping into my inbox for business advice and questions. Some of them are my peers. Some are people who, you know, random people from the public who need help or in my audiences who need help. But I spend a lot of time talking to my peers actually in my inbox, back and forth, quite a lot.
you also run some, you have products. So where do they fit in?
My products, thank God, are on autopilot. So I've autopiloted my products for now. I've actually gotten rid of some things that would need more time for me to focus on because I just don't have the time. I don't sleep enough anyway. So the product part of my business is pretty much on autopilot for physical products. For my classes and things, I try to run that as autopilot as possible, but we have group meetings that are live, individual coaching that's live that I try to do in the daytime or in the evening at about 8:30 or so. We have live trainings in the group. I try to have those. Well, now they're happening once a week with other people, but I try to push those once a month or so. There's just a constant flow of information, I think, that goes on with a lot of what I do.
What does 2020 and beyond look like for your business, your area of focus, and just what you're trying to do? Like, what are you working towards for yourself outside of what you're doing with Elevate?
So the goal for me is to not be working for somebody else. I still hold on to that because there is that paycheck. And I was consulting for a while. Kind of like it, kind of hate it because you have that independence, but not really. So the goal for me is to be fully full-time in my business because it's getting to that point, I think, where it needs me more. And the growth is stagnant because I don't have the time to spend with it. So for 2020 is the goal that I've set for myself, hopefully to be able to do that. Is that realistic? I don't know, but I'm at least trying to do that. Definitely pushing the Elevate, since Elevate is growing faster than I had anticipated, pushing Elevate to be a bigger portion of my business potentially, with the Next Elevate Influencer taking place in June, securing sponsorships and long-term partnerships and relationships that I think will help me towards being more independent, where I'm not, you know, focused on driving a lot of my income through work. A lot of the things that I do, I don't charge for. That takes up so much of my time right now, and pivoting and shifting that to include more premium services, because I do help quite a lot of people, but I realize that I have to be able to help myself to be able to help other people. It doesn't make sense if I'm working myself to death to help people that I can't help myself either, as well. So offering more of my premium services and launching my premium class that I built a year ago that I haven't really promoted.
Share the name of it now. I want to make sure that you do.
So it's a small business incubator, and it's focused on helping people to create a real business. And it really zooms in on a jumpstart for your business and everything that I felt like I didn't learn in business school to get you to be an entrepreneur. Having gone through so many thousands and thousands of people and seeing where they're failing, I thought I would put together a class that has everything that you could need, regardless of whatever kind of business you have, that will get your business going. And so that's a small business incubator. Because as we've discussed, people who retire early or whatever, they have their own businesses. And I think it's critical that all of us have some other income driver outside of our work. And I would prefer that it be your own business that you're able to run and do, you know, turn on, turn off, turn up if you need to supplement your income. So I'm really focused on driving that number up, real businesses, sustainable businesses that will really make other people money, and hence the small business incubator. So we'll definitely be focusing on that a lot more.
Before we wrap things up, I would love to talk about what you think is driving the numbers of Black women to create their own business. Like, what, I have my own theories on it, but what do you think is going on? And I actually think having a tool like your premium program will help us launch better. But what do you think is going on in the background behind the scenes where people are like, you know what, I'd rather take a leap of faith on myself than deal with you?
It's funny because I was at an event the other day for women in finance, and they were talking about why women felt like they were behind the eight ball in finance and not treated equally. And I piped up and was like, intersectional Black woman here. Why do you think Black women are starting businesses at such a fast rate?
It's like 300% the national average. It's such a significant percentage of women doing it that it's notable. So this is why, right, I'm bringing this up, listeners.
So I thought, here's my take on it. A Black woman are graduating college at a higher rate than any other time in history. We're more educated. However, we're hitting glass ceilings at a faster, earlier rate than anyone else. We're underemployed. You know, you've got, for me, for example, I have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, various certifications. And I know that it's taken me harder to get where I am than it has been for my peers. I've had to outwork them, etc. We see that. We're not stupid. So if you know that you're underemployed and you've got, you know, more education, we're not checking out of these corporations altogether. We're basically stepping to the side and we're saying, okay, I'll work at your job, but I'm going to work at my own thing as well. If you can't, if you refuse to give me the raise that I know that I deserve, if you're not paying me what I should be getting paid, if I'm not getting promoted, you know, as I should be getting, if I'm working twice as hard for you to get half as far as my peers, why should I dedicate more of that time to you when I can dedicate it to a business outside of this and, you know, advance that way? And so I see more women of color being more, I would say, just willing to take that risk of starting their businesses, because what do they have to lose? Mm-hmm. You know, they tend to be the ones who are, there were some studies at this event that I went to, and I was talking about the statistics that they didn't have for women of color, but they kind of had them on the back end. And whereas other ethnicities would feel threatened with some events, like a major life event, like a spouse passed away or whatever, and they would step back a little bit and focus more on family. It showed that women of color would step forward more and work harder to, you know, accomplish whatever they felt that they needed to accomplish. So it shows that under pressure, we're willing to take the risk and to do a little bit more work. And so I feel like more women of color, since they're not advancing the way that they want to within traditional industry and business, are just like, screw that, I'll do it on my own. Or I'll create this business on the side to supplement my income. Or I'll put in this extra time doing that thing to help me get further faster. So that's what I think is happening. And of course, you have your friends. If you've seen that your friend has done something and they've been successful, then yeah, they're going to think that it's possible for them as well. So if your girlfriend has started a business and, you know, she's bringing in an extra, I don't know, $2,000 a month or whatever, then you're motivated to do it as well. So, you know, that sister circle, that circle of friends will motivate you to do even better. In my group, I see it a lot. The group is 90-something% female. Most of them are definitely Black female for sure. And I see them motivating each other to do things and start things and to take that risk. And it's very exciting to see.
It's funny what your observations were for that topic because I lived it. And it's actually what I think as well. Basically, here's my experience of why I took the leap. I was working this job and I worked other jobs as well, but I consistently had experiences where I would get roadblocked for either a promotion, a raise that was like significant. Anyone who gets excited about a 3% raise, you're crazy. Like, it doesn't do anything for your life. I literally figured out what my 3% raise would be if I got one. There's systems in place to make sure you don't get those kind of raises, by the way. So you're leaping through all these hoops to hopefully get what I figured out to be was like a quarter an hour based on all the extra work that I was doing. And once I figured out that 3% of my year's worth of salary to income was going to break down to be about a quarter an hour, I was like, this is insanity. This makes no sense. And so I had experiences where I wanted to market the program that I worked for. I worked with international students at an international English center in order to get those students to attend the school. Most programs like that will go to fairs, overseas fairs, in order to market the program. Was speaking with I had two different directors who did this to me. I was like, you know, I'd love to be the person who does this. And I was told no. In retrospect, I understand why they said no. First of all, they said, no, we don't feel comfortable with you representing our program. That's what I was told. But in retrospect, if I were to have attended those events, that was an opportunity that they couldn't have. And so they were going to say no. And so I had to figure out how to facilitate the opportunities that I wanted for myself. I just had to. And I can't wait for other people I can't wait for a person who can open the door for you. I cannot believe I just brain farted. Andy, you know what I mean? The person who, like a gatekeeper. So yep. I couldn't wait for a gatekeeper who would be like, you know what? I really believe that this is an opportunity for you. And I'm happy to step aside so you could do that. It was just not going to happen.
Yep.
So, you know, that's why I created Money on the Mountain, because I was like, it became an international event, had people coming over from Canada. I marketed, I did all the skills and things that I wanted to do for mm-hmm. that program, which I was 100% in love with, in alignment with. And once I had those experiences more than once over and over again, I was like, I don't feel any kind of way about this business anymore. I don't feel emotionally connected to you at all, because yep. every time you stepped on my dream, that killed that connection.
Yep. And good. So you're observing exactly what I think that I've observed as well. So, you know, companies, you're on notice. These women are more assertive than they've ever been before. We're taking the lessons to heart that we should ask for what we want and what we think we deserve. But if that's not happening, we're willing to start our own businesses. And if they grow enough, and that's where I'm hoping to come in to help women grow, create and grow their businesses, because that's where we're kind of stuck. We're just not growing our businesses. But if we grow enough, we're going to be just stepping out to doing our own things full time.
And that's what I do now. And my boss is great because my boss lets me sleep in when I want to. And my boss lets me go to the mountains when I want to and like work from there. And I get to exercise when I want to. I don't have to ask permission. I work hard, but I can make sure that every opportunity that I can conceive of and dream of, I can do.
Yep.
And there you go. So with that being said, how can we be a part of what you're doing? How can we stay in touch with you, Sandy?
So you can find me at yesaimcheap.com. If you're looking for a side hustle, thehustlecrew.com. Everything else about me is at iamsandysmith.com.
Thank you, Sandy.
Thanks, Michelle.